This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Antik. Doping was a major blip of an otherwise uplifting Summer Olympics in Rio. Other than the discovery of the Russian state-sponsored doping scandal, athletes who tested positive in the past were booed by peers and the audience during their events. Sports lawyers Richard Wee and Brian Song are here to talk about how doping cases are investigated as well as what happens when athletes are caught cheating. Richard, Brian, welcome.
Hi, Ante. How are you?
So I guess, Richard, this whole show started because we had a conversation a month or two ago, and I remember you saying you wanted to cover doping because the Olympics was coming up. You said that the whole of doping is law. What did you mean by that?
Well, people will always see doping as a cheat for sports. And actually, in the true core of the concept of sports doping lies sports law. And this is the law which governs the operation of testing an athlete, the veracity of the test, the accuracy of the test, and of course the results from the test. And then after the results is discovered positive or negative, especially if it's positive, then what happens after that? There'll be the usual adjudication, hearings, finding of guilt, and then eventually punishment. So that effectively, if you hear that, is no different from a person getting caught having drugs in the street, except this involves in sports. But what is peculiar, as I perhaps have mentioned with you outside this show, is that it's very funny when people hear about sports doping. People hear someone involved in sports and the person is punished, and then when they take part later, people just say, "Oh yeah, you know, he was formerly caught for drugs and he can take part." But if you use the same chemical product and go to a club and shake your head and call it ecstasy, you go to prison and people say, "Oh, that's wrong, you know, you shouldn't do that." So it is also very funny how people by nature perceive sports doping and drugs with chemical usage. It's very funny.
Who defines what is banned and what is not banned? Who sets the rules?
Well, in the world of anti-doping, the main agency is the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. They are a very effective, and the organization constantly update the list of anti-performance-enhancing drugs, so to say. And this may include, of course, the things like cocaine and heroin, so of course, also in the list. But in the list of things which athletes should not consume will include things like certain medication, certain chemicals, etc. So WADA is the one who has the list, and they update it every year.
So I can understand why performance-enhancing drugs would not be allowed. But party drugs, why is it the business of WADA?
Yeah, of course, if the drugs is not performance-enhancing, usually the WADA is not involved. But there is some sense of morality that, you know, if your player is in cocaine, then you will be suspended. One classic example was Adrian Mutu, the player from Chelsea about 12 years or 14 years ago. And he was tested positive for, if I'm not mistaken, cocaine. And eventually, he was suspended. And in fact, his contract was terminated. You know, so while it wasn't technically performance enhancing, but it was also illegal to take the drugs. And I think it's a correct thing to do.
Brian, how are athletes monitored or investigated?
Generally, when you look at the code itself, one of the requirements of the code requires the athletes to report on their whereabouts and to also go through tests within a fixed period, 12 months, which require them to go through 3 tests. If they fail to turn up for any of those tests, then that is a violation under the code itself. Then you'll be subject to suspension depending on the severity of it.
What happens when an athlete is found positive?
When an athlete is found positive, then we would have to ascertain what is the banned substance that contained in the sample itself. Generally, you have sample A and sample B. That's the urine sample.
So you have to give two cups?
Yes, correct.
Tested separately
at separate occasions. What happens is that you will always test on the sample A. So if you are tested positive for sample A, you will be notified that you have a chance to have sample B tested. So if sample B is tested positive as well, then we have to go into defending the athlete's position as to what has happened, what is the substance that actually gone into the body or the blood or urine itself, that's what I meant, mm-hmm. and work from there how we need to defend the case.
Is the list of banned substance very long? Can an athlete be reasonably expected to know everything that is on that list?
I don't believe the athlete is expected to know what is on that list in its entirety. But as a prudent athlete, you need to be well aware of what you consume. What I mean is that you don't look at the bigger picture, as in look through the whole list to see what is actually banned. You looked at what you have before you, whether it contains those banned substance. So what you need to do is you talk to your doctors, you talk to your nutritionist, these are the two key people, and also maybe your family members that prepare the food.
So coming back to what you were saying, if they are found positive, if both sample A and sample B is found positive, what are some of the grounds for appeal? What kinds of defense can an athlete come up with?
That basically two broad categories of defense. It's either there is no fault or negligence at all. This is a very high standard for you to actually prove that there's no fault or negligence on your part. All right. And for this category, by way of example, if let's say one of your defense is that my wife has prepared food for me, I don't know about it. My coach has given me medications. I don't know what is inside. I have been consuming certain supplements without going through what is on the label. This is actually not part of the defense for no fault or negligence.
That's the unintentional or unknowingly consuming.
No, that is a separate category where we talk about no significant fault of negligence. When you look at the code itself, intention is not an important factor to determine whether there's a violation.
Right.
Intention is only important for you to ascertain the
punishment.
Defense, the
right.
punishment. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Richard, what is the definition for performance enhancing?
Definition.
Yeah. And well, when did it become illegal? Because all vitamins are performance enhancing, right?
Yeah, generally. Actually, there is a technical definition to this, but let me just explain things to make it easier. Basically, if anybody consume anything, you know, it could be even the normal plain water, but that plain water or that bread that you eat gives you an added energy which normally will not be given to you. And that will mean that when you step onto the track, for example, to run, you end up running faster than other people. Not because you took supplements, which is accepted, but you took something which had altered the way your body react to that thing that you eat. So classic one, let me use examples which people know. Ben Johnson in 1988, he took what now known, world-known famous steroids. Everyone, the whole world know about steroids because of that case. So what happens with steroids is that, actually steroids is a normal medication. People take steroids all the time. You go to hospital, if you're not well, you have a certain pain, doctor may prescribe steroids to you. But when consumed by an athlete with an intention to run, in Ben's case, steroids give him an unexpected burst of power at the point of to start off the run. And that's why, if you recall, in 1988, when the gun went off, the first 10 meters, he was already ahead by 1 meter because of that special burst of power artificially created by the usage of steroid, which gave his muscles calf an extra added jump. So that's what WADA does. They have a group of scientists who works with a group of lawyers. They will study certain chemicals, certain medicines, certain food, whether it actually gives you this kind of artificial and not meant to be given to kind of, basically making yourself a Superman when you shouldn't be a Superman. So, but of course, you know, people take vitamin C, you know, people take whatever vitamins. So WADA does go through the list and says, look, you know, there's certain things which you can take. We understand. You want to stay healthy, essence of chicken, you know, go ahead. But if you consume something to artificially give your body artificial power, then WADA may step in and say, that you can't take.
I'm speaking today to Richard Wee and Brian Song. Both are sports lawyers, and we're talking about doping in sports. Up next, I'd like to ask them more about how punishment are dished to athletes who have been found guilty of doping. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Antik. Today, the topic we're talking about is doping in sports. Doping was very pertinent because the Olympics just concluded. If I remember watching a few events where athletes were very vocal about their fellow competitors who have been found guilty in the past. And I just want to play a few clips of swimmers who spoke out during those days of competition, and I'll get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, definitely a win for a good guy. So I don't know if it's a rivalry between me and him, just me and athletes who have tested positive, I guess.
That was the Australian 400-metre swimmer, Mac Horton, talking about his competitor, Sun Yang, the Chinese swimmer, who was convicted of doping. The next clip I wanted to play is one of Lily King, the American 100-metre breaststroke swimmer, who was commenting about her Russian rival, Yulia Efimova, who up to, I think, a week before the Olympics were unsure of her participation at the Olympics.
You're shaking your finger number one and you've been caught for drug cheating. I'm just not, you know, not a fan.
So,
interesting.
A lot of things here that I want to talk about. One is, I guess, punishment, right? Athletes who have been found guilty, some are punished more severely than others. I can remember Lance Armstrong, for example. He was banned for life when he was found guilty for doping. And another example, Justin Gatlin, the American sprinter, 100-meter sprinter, who competed with Bolt during the Rio finals for 100-meter, was allowed to compete in Rio despite being found guilty of doping twice in the past. Brian, how are sentences dished out, and who are the adjudicators?
Okay, when we looked at the code itself, I mean, if there is someone that has violated the doping code, we are looking at a 4 years suspension. And you mitigate or you defend your case from that 4 years period and see how much more you can get it reduced.
So one substance, 4 years.
Yes, okay. That's how we start that off, right? And as to when the ineligibility period starts or suspension starts, that you can get it backdated as far as the date your sample is taken. But generally, it could also start from the date of the decision itself. So if you're asking why some of them are punished more severely than others, I could only say that each case has different set of facts. Each case has different sets of mitigation factors and defense.
Right.
So once a person is caught positive, the relevant association that comes in will be the federation that actually governs that sports. Let's say if we talk about badminton, that would go under BWF. If we talk about athletics, it will go under IAAF. So these federations will hear the case and decide what kind of penalty or suspension period that they will mete out. And then from there, you take the decision to cast. If you're not happy with that particular decision, you can always appeal. So you don't directly go under the purview of CAS.
In the Olympics instance, correct me if I'm wrong, it was the IOC, the International Olympics Council, who decided who gets to participate and who gets... they are the one who decide whether or not to take on the recommendations from these associations?
Yes, they do.
Yes. In essence, the IAF, for example, or the BWF, they have the power to recommend whether or not someone can participate, but it is the organizers of competitions, the World Championships or Olympics, who decide whether or not an athlete get to compete.
Once an athlete qualified on a standard given set by the Olympic Council, then he or she should be allowed to play. Of course, it's your question, we should ask to Brian. If a person attains a standard from that sports, then that association will submit that name to IOC. I've not heard of IOC saying no. Mm. I mean, at this stage, IOC would have to say yes, unless there's something wrong with the player. Yeah. Suspended.
Unless there's a suspension period that's still effective. So coming back to your question on why a person that has breached or violated the doping rule is allowed to come back for the second time and compete, that's because they have actually served the suspension period. Mm-hmm. And it's over.
Right. Okay. So that's the legal side. But from what I've read, someone who is displaying behavior that suggests doping can be deliberately selected for tests, someone who has maybe improved by leaps and bounds over a short period of time. Is this not unfair?
Well, if you look at through the WADA, their guidelines, actually athletes are not targeted. They are very randomly selected. In fact, even the process of randomly selecting the athlete is legally controlled. There is a particular way to choose. So, for example, if the WADA steps into Finch Farm, Everton's training ground, and they want to test an Everton player, they would have abruptly informed Everton, go in, and randomly choose a player based on a particular process. So they will not go and target a player. An example is, so that's during competition in the Premier League. So in IOC, once you finish your race, from what I understand, all the athletes are required to immediately give your urine test. But sometimes, even within that contest, you may be called upon because of the way it's selected. And it's there, it's all in the code. So that I would not say that if an athlete suddenly shows superpower strength, that the WADA will immediately purposely target that chap. I don't think so. If the random test process points towards the athlete, then yeah, they'll test the person.
Do top athletes, for example, get tested more often than the rest?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, they do. Yes, they do. Makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, because they are on top. And the higher you go, the WADA will test you more.
Other than I think, Brian, you mentioned that there's regularly scheduled tests. Are there any complaints about the processes or the system that WADA has? Because there's a lot of athletes in a lot of sports. Is WADA sufficiently... Do they have enough resources to go and test every athlete's sample?
I mean, each country or... that they go, they have an accredited laboratory to conduct all these tests with the relevant officials appointed to see the athletes, take that sample and get it tested. So I would believe that they have sufficient resources to get this done, to implement the provisions of the code to ensure fair play in sports.
Richard, one of the talking points of this Olympics was the Russian state-sponsored...
The one with the clips that you were playing earlier.
Yeah, substance. How did this happen?
That is a mystery for all of us in the world of sports. But the moment it was discovered, I think WADA took immediate steps to, one, you know, check on it, two, form the necessary commission to investigate it, and we saw the report, and eventually proposed punishments were granted out. Of course, as we know, at the end, I think the IOC left it to the relevant sports association to decide with regards to the Russian athletes. And the Paralympic, as you know, made a total ban on all Russian Olympics or Olympians. So it's up to the association to decide, and that's what they did. To be fair, the Russian doping. We don't really know exactly what happened, Brian. I mean, it's still up in there. We only read what we have, and it was quite sudden, the discovery of this Russian so-called drug process, you know, for the players. But what is important is for us to take home from this is this: two things. The public outcry that we want everyone to be playing the game fairly. So play by the rules. And you can see that the public, I don't think they were purposely selecting Russia. It could have been any country. It just happened to be Russia that people want any athlete to appear in the Olympics to be clean. And also, and the moment there's a perception that you may not be clean, then every time you win something at the Olympics, it's tainted, it's potentially tainted. And that does affect the sanctity of the event itself, you know. So that's what happened with the Russian thing. I think basically the WADA stepped in and tried to remedy it, and unfortunately, sports bureaucracy took over, and we saw what happened in the end in Russia.
Under what circumstances would a medal or a title be rescinded once you are found guilty of doping?
Well, the Ben Johnson one was a classic example. He won the gold medal in 1988 with a world record, by the way, 100 metres at that time. And the moment he was found guilty, not only the medal was taken away, the record was deleted.
But you have to prove that that the substance was taken at the time of competition.
Yes, yes.
So if he has won, like for example, the Olympic title 4 years prior, he can still keep that?
Not really. Look at Lance Armstrong. If evidence can lead towards usage of performance-enhancing drugs at the time of your victory, even 10 years ago, it's possible to take punishment. You must remember, Untik, at the end of the day, the big picture is this. The big picture of this whole entire topic of sports doping is to try and give that young boy or young girl who's now training, who's going to try and win an Olympic in, say, archery or whatever, that he or she, in 5 to 6 years' time, when he or she take part, he or she will fight and compete with somebody else on equal measure. Not because the other fella next to me is on steroids. So WADA, through its effort, is trying to ensure that the entire sports is clean. It's not a perfect process. I personally have my own comments against the process. But I think that the whole idea is to try and give every potential young athlete the hope that they are taking part in a real competition. Yeah,
Brian?
Just to add a little bit on what Richard has said on your question as well. If somebody has won a medal 4 years ago and what happens now and all that, under the code itself, before 1st January 2015, WADA can go as far as 8 years to retest that sample.
Yeah.
Now that provision has been changed to 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Why that change is because technology has advanced. So you can actually use a more advanced technology to actually test a sample that was taken many, many years ago.
And wow. they can now discover. So like I think... Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, Lance Armstrong, not only was he guilty of using so-called drugs, but he had used some kind of drugs to camouflage drugs.
That's actually a masking agent. So masking agent is one of the prohibited substance or methods.
Right.
You know, so you actually dope yourself and then you use something to mask whatever that you have done to yourself. That is
so
not allowed.
During testing, they cannot find out. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. So they keep your sample for now up to 10 years.
Yes. Yeah.
So on that spirit, like what Brian say, 10 years ago, they couldn't find it, that masking agent. Now they can. So they test you again.
I guess we've been building up to this. The highest court, the Supreme Court, to decide all of these things is the Court of Arbitration for Sports. And it was created in 1984. Who sits on this court?
Well, for CAS, the headquarters is in Lausanne in Switzerland. I think the gentleman who's the director there is Mr. Matthew Reap. It's managed like an arbitration center. For the arbitrators, there's a list of arbitrators who has been selected over the years. And every time there is a relevant hearing, the relevant arbitrator will be appointed by a particular selection process. CAS, while physically located in Switzerland, but they have hearing centres all over the world. In fact, the good news is that Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, is one of the selected centres in the world. And all all CAS cases may be heard in Kuala Lumpur Regional Centre of Arbitration, KLRCA. So we are quite honoured to have that. It goes to show the standard and status of our Centre of Arbitration. So to answer your question, who sits in the arbitration body? Arbitrators who are listed in the CAS list. It can be lawyers, it can be retired athletes, it can be retired sports administrators who qualify to hear such a case. There are tests to go through to become a sports arbitrator.
There has been a case which is challenging the supremacy of the authority of this court. And this is the case of
Claudia
Pechstein.
Yep.
She's a German speed skater, the most decorated winter Olympian in Germany. And she was found guilty of doping in 2009. And she's adamant that she was innocent. And she attributes it to a genetic defect that causes her blood to display that positive result.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about that case?
Well, that case is a ping pong in courts.
It's been a 7-year battle.
Yeah, so it was heard in CAS and she was found guilty of doping, and then she challenged the CAS hearing in Germany. I don't really want to bore the listeners with the details, but basically she challenged it in a German court and she won at the first instance in the High Court. Then that hearing, it was appealed, the Court of Arbitration appealed against that decision. It went upstairs, so per se, in the higher courts in Germany, and CAS won. Mm-hmm. The decision of CAS was upheld. Now Claudia is launching another action to say that, if I can just go off tangent for a short while, all athletes, when they take part in competitions like FIFA World Cup or Olympics or Commonwealth Games, they have to sign a certain agreement. One of the clause in the agreement is that they will accept the jurisdiction of CAS. And now Claudia is challenging that process of execution of the agreement, saying that when she signed the agreement, she was not properly advised, and therefore she was effectively forced to sign that agreement. So that is developing, and we haven't seen the end of that case yet. So maybe in a few months' time, I'll tell you. But it's very interesting. It goes to show the process of not just sports adjudication, but the due process. That not only you have a way to hear a case, you will also not have a way to challenge the way you hear the case. Right. So this is good. This is good for development of sports law, yeah.
Yeah, because it's about, if I'm understanding correctly, whether or not local laws can be appealed to against the CAS law.
Yeah, that's always been an ongoing battle. Whether, for example, let's say you use Malaysia. So if a Malaysian athlete is not happy with a decision of their association, so let's say a club Persatuan Sukan ABC find an athlete guilty through their internal hearings, and then the athlete take the matter to CAS, again find guilty, can he or she take it to the High Court? That matter is a grey area, but many, many Malaysian cases, for example, have made a decision that always exhaust all remedies in the sports association before you come to court. And even when you come to court, you don't appeal. You apply for judicial review to decide whether or not the hearing process was fair, justiciable. Yeah, lawyers will know about this. But for the listeners who are not lawyers, basically, you only go to High Court after you complete all and exhaust all your hearings in the association.
So in the end, what did we learn from this Olympics in light of what we see from Russia? What is the message in the fight against doping? Where are we going next?
Well, I'll do this first before I think Brian will be able to answer this too. Well, if you look at the clips that you just played, or you listen to the clips that you just played, sometimes doping is not won by the battle of courtrooms. The best victory sometimes by way of public perception. And this outburst by athletes who were clearly unhappy to compete with athletes they perceive to be not clean is a good way to remind other athletes, be careful. And, you know, the moment people perceive you to be not clean, sponsors will not come to you. Potential investors won't invest in that game. You lose out in the long term. Look at Mr. Armstrong, top of the world 15 years ago, now totally down. And nobody will ever listen to him ever again. So I think what I will take away from the Olympics, specifically about doping, is that it is the remarkable, the spirit of the people who watched it, followed it, took part in it, that they, in the end, celebrated fair play by asking everyone to be clean. You know, and that's good. That's a good message. And hopefully the young future athletes, the next Usain Bolt, will think twice before they consume drugs in sports.
Right.
Right. I mean, generally when we talk about Olympics, I would say Olympics is the ultimate game. Everyone watches it. Gold medals, any medals that you get yourself is an honour or something that the athlete would treasure. So everyone goes all out to win. But to win that medal, there must be some form of regulations to regulate them through fair play and all that. So which is why you have the anti-doping code that comes into picture. How do we then fight against doping? It's actually an ongoing battle. You have a much more advanced technology. You would definitely have a much more advanced method of doping yourself if your ultimate intention is to cheat and win. So if you look at the doping code itself, it's constantly changing. You know, in 2009, 2013, 2015, various amendments have been made, especially with 2015, the substantial changes that have been made. And the list of prohibited substances change every year, and it's a longer list each and every year. So it's basically doing more to counter what that may come in the future through all these things.
It's like technology, you're always playing catch up. Regulations always catching
yes,
up
correct.
To
you have
new
to catch
farmer.
Up. You definitely have to catch up with the game because everyone gets very innovative.
Yeah, it's good. I think most athletes may not like WADA, but I think WADA is good for us. But I just hope that people in WADA who may be listening to this, you know, they cannot be overzealous also. There's also the element of give and take, you know. But however, the moment an athlete is suspected to be on drugs, then actually all of us as fans of sports must support WADA to make sure that that person is caught. Yeah, every one athlete caught for drugs, it stops 10 other athletes from taking drugs. That's a good way to look at it.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Antik.
Thanks.
I've been speaking to Richard Wee and Brian Song, both are sports lawyers, about doping in sports. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.